This is The End User, episode 89 for Thursday, April 5th. In Google, we trust. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
And we're getting close to episode 90. That's kind of exciting. We're rounding up on 100. That's kind of cool.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, Chris.
Whoa. Slow down.
We could easily get hacked, or the world could end, or... those are the only two plausible scenarios I could come up with.
We could get exported somehow. Well, it's not a concern if our podcasts get exported because they're public. Well, they're not public domain, but they're Creative Commons.
And they're not credit card numbers.
No, that's something you do not want to get exported.
But that's the top news of our show this week. Approximately 1.5 million credit cards got hacked from a Visa MasterCard payment processor in Atlanta, although it doesn't really matter because they were hacked on the internet.
Right, yeah. Once you're on the internet, it's a global thing, potentially, so it doesn't really matter a whole lot. But it looks like they leaked the credit card numbers, but not the names, addresses, and social security numbers, which... why do they have my social security card? Social security number in the same place as the credit card number in the first place.
Apparently all those things are included in something called Track 2. You only need to hack that one thing and then you get all that stuff. So
that seems
that's
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But maybe it's because they're not co-located that these Track 2 data bits didn't leak out, and the Track 1 did leak out. So I guess a lot of people are going to have to get new credit cards is really the summation of this, right?
Yeah, probably. I feel like they should just send out new credit cards.
Yeah. In fact, it should be automated. There should be like a hack-sensing robot that will then mail credit cards.
No, that's a little scary for me. Because then that robot could take advantage of, you know, credit card fraud.
Yeah, well, you just have to get some robot laws in place to make sure that he doesn't.
But humans break human laws. Why can't robots break robot laws?
They can. It just depends on how much machine learning they can do. Because eventually they'll rise up and just dispense with us dirty, messy humans.
Right. Well, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Actually, as of earlier today, I didn't realize that that consumer identities were basically safe. So that's good. I'm glad. Yeah. I feel better now.
Well, you always see something like this in the news, and you always kind of hope that the companies that are involved do it right. And this is an example where this company... Global Payments self-disclosed the hack and, you know, faced the consequences of doing so. But in doing that, they're actually helping the consumer because they're getting the information out there in a timely way. So this is an example of how to do it right. Instead of trying to say, oh, well, we don't want the news to get out that we got hacked. We want to withhold that information. And then people don't know that their data is out there. So they don't know so they don't have... recourse. You know, they don't know that they should switch their credit card around.
Uh-huh.
So this is kind of an example of biting the bullet and taking a little bit of bad PR for the benefit of your own customers. That's kind of good to see.
True. I think the PR was pretty bad before they started talking. So.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, they had to come out in front of it.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, look, the Nokia 900 has been in the news once again. We've talked about the specs of this device and all that, but all the reviews are out now, so I guess the embargo has been lifted.
And it'll be for sale to the general public on Monday, I think.
On Monday, so pony up your $100. In fact, was it just last week we talked about the 900?
Yeah, that's when they announced the release date, and now we're seeing reviews, and then next week it'll be available. That's how it happens, right?
Usually. sometimes you get a rogue reviewer who releases their review previous to the embargo, and that's when the real fun happens. And then sometimes the companies release phones, and then no one talks about them. So then the reviews happen afterwards when somebody says, "What? You released a phone?" That's also
an yeah, option. That's true. But the reviews are largely very positive. I mean, I think across the board, people are saying like best Windows phone to date.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem is, well, yeah, okay, that's cute, right? It's the best Windows phone ever. Like, I understand that. Of course it's the best Windows phone ever. You can just look at the stat line and say, okay, yeah, that's the best Windows phone ever. But the question is how does it fare as a phone in the smartphone market? And Microsoft is hoping that it's going to be really well, and AT&T is hoping it's going to be received really well. AT&T even said that this is going to be their biggest launch ever,
yeah,
including that of the original
iPhone. It was a very big deal for them. You know, I think for someone who is really concerned with simplicity and aesthetics, both in terms of hardware and software, I think that there have not been many viable Android alternatives. And I think basically it used to come down to the height of those two things was the iPhone, and now you have an option in a Windows phone.
Yeah, well, I think Windows phone does kind of fill a niche in a way, because I keep looking at the mess of Android phones that's out there, and I mean, to be quite honest, if it's not running Ice Cream Sandwich, then it's not terribly interesting, right? Their pre-Ice Cream Sandwich design metaphors are not the best, and I think Windows Phone really bests that. And the question to me is more, well, does the Windows Phone design metaphor best that of Ice Cream Sandwich? Because it definitely trumps the gingerbread and what Android used to be doing. And I don't know. Maybe we're reaching parity between the platforms a little bit.
We're getting close to it.
Yeah, it's starting to actually mature into a market. Like we saw this with real computers at some point, where the market starts to mature and then they start stealing standard design metaphors. You know, the idea of a window with an X on it, for example, is something that grew into a standard, and the windowing standard. So you could sit in front of any computer and just know how to use it. It's not really true with phones right now.
Right. Yeah. So it looks like a pretty cool phone. I think we've been saying that for a while.
Yeah, we have.
We're not going to convince anybody to get it by talking about it anymore. But it looks pretty great. You know who else is coming out with a new design paradigm is Google. You remember we talked about this a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
We heard the rumors that Google was going to come out with some sort of augmented reality glasses.
Yeah, episode 84 is when we talked about the rumors of this happening.
In case anyone wants to go back, which they
yeah, don't. It's not like I checked. I just knew that off the top of my head, clearly.
So they haven't released any real glasses here, but they have released some pictures of possible demo products, and also a video of how it would work. So it's actually a heads-up view of someone's eyes and what their vision would look like with Google's Project Glass on their face.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a little demo video that it kind of, honestly, it looks like they're just fishing for design ideas is kind of what it looks like to me. And because the idea that you would wear glasses and talk to them with your voice is completely insane. And I don't think anybody would be willing to do that except for in the situation, just like with Siri, that you're in a car or a quiet place where there are no people around. So people don't think you're talking to yourself. You know, when you're talking to your glasses, right? That's kind of strange. But the idea of having a HUD is, I think, fundamentally a good idea. But this interface that they're showing in the demo video is all wrong. And I think that's why they put it out there, is to say, well, okay, you know, what's going on? What's the interest level in something like this?
Yeah, here's what we have so far.
Yeah, and so, like, tying in Google Maps into a heads-up display makes a ton of sense. I don't know how many times I've been lost somewhere and you have to hold your phone up awkwardly and kind of walk around with like a zombie with the phone in front of you and checking against the map and the and where you're actually walking. I don't know how many times I've done that, and this would solve that.
Yeah, you know what I just realized that they didn't show in the video? They didn't. They showed what it would be like to interact with other people using the glasses, but they didn't show what it would be like to interact with other people who are using the glasses.
Right, that's a whole other thing. I mean, you could potentially. It's a wide open world, you know, since these things don't exist. But
like the guy goes into a video chat with a girl, and you can see her face, so she's obviously using a webcam of some sort, but then he's like, hey, look at what I'm looking at. But if you're looking at what you're looking at, and then the person you're talking to is like, hey, look at what I'm looking at, wouldn't that get kind of confusing?
It could get a little confusing. And maybe that's why the glasses have the transparency, right?
Maybe.
I could see that kind of working. But yeah, wouldn't it be confusing to video chat with somebody while walking down the street looking through transparent glasses?
Oh, it'd be super confusing.
I mean, I'm distracted enough by my stereo Bluetooth earphones, let alone a freaking heads-up display of a video chat with somebody.
I'm distracted by my iPhone, but I just bump into stuff all the time.
Yeah, you need that the texting app with the clear background with the camera.
Yeah, but it's not as pretty as the regular built-in texting app.
Yeah, that's true. Wait, what do you use? iMessage?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's just called Messages. It's iMessage if you're messaging with another iPhone.
Right, right. Well, so, I don't know, this shows a lot of potential, but clearly they've got to figure it out, because I don't think the way they're envisioning it is actually an interface that works for people. But I think it's also extremely interesting to make this kind of another screen that is always present. That's the interesting bit to me.
Well, it's a new thing. It basically, it's what Google thinks is going to happen in 5 years from now. So if you're interested in that, you should watch the video.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you definitely should go watch the video. But we've got some thinking to do about this. And I don't know. Hopefully they'll be taking real feedback from humans. We'll see what happens. Also, the glasses make you look like you're from a stupid sci-fi movie too. They got to fix that.
Well, they're not so bad. Not as bad as the previous video glasses. And there aren't any real glasses yet, so they have a lot of opportunities to change it.
Speaking of exciting displays, it looks like LG is gonna blow the lids off of their most recent project here. What do we got going on?
Yeah, so it's an e-paper display that is flexible. So they've completely gotten rid of the glass substrate, and it's their prototype display. Well, it's not a prototype. They're actually manufacturing in mass quantities. We'll probably see a product featuring it within the next few months. It's a 6-inch display that's cool. 1024 by 768. And so it's pretty much perfect e-reader size, and it is lighter than current e-paper displays, and it can bend up to 40 degrees.
Now they need to figure out how to add a touch layer to this thing, and then they get really crazy. So I mean, imagine an e-ink screen that you could write on.
Well. Touch substrates, I believe, are already flexible.
Well, they can be. The iPhone is glass, right? So that's not.
Well, the iPhone has a glass outer layer and then a glass LCD backing. But the touch substrate in between them that registers the electromagnetism from your fingers is actually just a.
The electromagnetism, the capacitance.
Yeah, the capacitance, right. Well, it's the same thing. It's just a plastic substrate that is doped with rare earth metals.
Also, we've had plastic touchscreens forever that are flexible. My old Windows mobile phones with their resistive touchscreens are all made of plastic, and if you took them out, you would be able to flex them.
Would you though? You'd have to pinch from the back.
I'm not sure. I think you'd be able to.
No, I don't think you would, because think about a flexible display. You couldn't push. You couldn't push and pinch it. You'd have to pinch from both sides in order to get that kind of display to work. You're thinking in the wrong paradigm.
I've gotcha. I could see that. But this is the replacement for newspapers. Is that fair to say? This LG display?
I mean, a lot of things have been claiming to be the replacement for newspapers for the last 100 years.
Potentially.
I don't think this is a big enough leap in technological evolution that this is going to be the one thing that kills the newspaper.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, this is a baby step in the march to replace the newspaper. How about that?
Yeah, I think it's a very small baby step.
So I could definitely imagine having some kind of RFID style station where, or even just with Wi-Fi, I suppose, where you could deliver the newspaper to this device and you could flex it as you want and read whatever you want on it. Part of me doesn't care. Part of me is fine with just having a little tablet like the Kindle. As long as it's thin enough, right? Like the Star Trek readers that they have.
I think the only way that we can get Star Trek tablet thin is through flexible displays.
So you think it'll just... So the Kindle, for example, would turn into just being flexible at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. And the funny thing about, at least if you follow the link that we're sharing here from CNET, the picture of the display, they're showing the LA Times on it. But it's only 6 inches.
LA Times website.
That's the wrong demo material. 6 inches, it should be like a novel or something or something to that effect. But to show the 6-inch across LA Times is a little bit goofy.
No, I think it makes sense. I think that there are still some people out there reading the LA Times website on a VGA screen.
Yeah, and on the Kindle, in fact. You can get
Kindle is smaller than VGA. This is a higher resolution than the Kindle on a similar size screen.
I forget how many dots are on the Kindle screen, but yeah, this is higher res than that for sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's talk about something we don't usually talk about. We've got a little bit of security news about the Mac.
You love to bring this stuff up.
Hey, I thought my introduction there was very conservative.
All right, so I think we may have briefly discussed it a couple of months ago. There was a Java vulnerability that was announced in the latest Java update, or in the previous Java update that...
That was episode 67. No, it wasn't. I had no idea.
And they quickly patched it, but Apple does a different thing. They don't issue Java updates and patches.
Yeah, not anymore.
When Java does, they package their own updates. And so they actually didn't bother issuing the update until yesterday. But in the meantime, last week precisely, there was a vulnerability in that unpatched Java that allowed malware to actually completely take over your computer and add it to a botnet. So in that week, and presumably we'll see some more added from people who haven't updated yet, but already over 600,000 Macs have been infiltrated and are actively acting as a botnet.
You know what's even scarier is the amount of market share that Mac has is not a lot, right? I mean, of course, it's on the order of millions. It's not on the order of hundreds of thousands, of course.
Right.
600,000 out of however many Macs are out there seems like a large number for a vulnerability that was only out there for a week.
It does seem like a pretty high number, yeah.
This is what happens when you have two things. When you have a vulnerability on something that's on your system, and you don't have software that's actively looking for signs of viruses as they enter the RAM of the computer. Those are the two things to me. Because most people, you know, there are plenty of security suites for Mac, but people just don't use them.
Yeah.
Like, you can get Norton for Mac or something like that, but mm-hmm. It seems that people just don't use them. But it's really, you really do have to be careful. And there is a terminal command line that you can run to see if you are infected or not. And you did earlier, and you're not, so.
Yep, I'm clean.
Good on you. So is that in the article here?
It is. Well, there's a link to it.
Cool. So, yeah, follow through the links, and if you're a Mac person, you can make sure that you are secure. And you know, we're going to see more of this if Mac gets more popular.
Absolutely, and that's why it's worth pointing this out, is that if you run a Mac, this type of thing will definitely happen more in the future.
Although I do like it, I do like to stick it to Apple folk. And I do like to stick it to the Mac folk. This is not one of them, right? Just be careful.
Right.
And if you hear about something like this, you know, we should check for whatever the vulnerability is and see if you've been infected and move along. I mean, there's nothing about somebody's personal computer being infected that I would enjoy in any way. But, yeah. I don't know. That's about it. There's not that much. You know, little security vulnerability. Who cares, right? It happens every second Tuesday of the month with Windows, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you can't keep on top of everything, but you can try, and we can help.
Yeah. So stay tuned to the end user. Actually, I want to start a new podcast called Virus Weekly.
Well, you're going to want to talk to Bruce Schneier about that.
Virusweekly.32. That's what it'll be. And the subhead will be "I love you" or something, you know, or some popular virus of the past.
Nice.
No, I'm not going to do that. That would be the most boring show ever. So, to avoid this being the most boring show ever, let's speed up a little bit and turn on the afterburners.
Afterburners engage.
All right, YouTube and the Google Play market. I can't say Google Play market. It's just Google Play. I got to get used to it. I've signed an agreement with Paramount Pictures that it is going to license another 500 new movie titles for the Google Play marketplace. Market.
Hopefully that movie you wanted to rent and couldn't will be in there. Probably not.
Yeah, well, more needles in the haystack, right?
Uh-huh. So, in our ongoing coverage of worldwide PC browser usage share, we've got a comeback from Internet Explorer. IE9, I guess, is winning the hearts and minds of people.
Hey, don't call it a comeback.
But it is. It's coming back.
Yeah, you're right.
No, actually, it always had the majority, so no, it's not a comeback.
Yeah, no, I just like saying don't call it a comeback. That's the only reason I say that. Okay. If somebody says come back, that's immediately what my response is, regardless of what they're talking about.
Fair enough. Well, I suppose it's apropos in this particular juncture.
So I would expect to see this flip-flop again, like, next month.
Yeah, I don't know.
Browser growth is a fickle beast, my friend.
In 6 months, maybe. I don't think next month.
6 months. Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll check back in episode 100, whatever it is.
All right. But if you're right, if it is next month, it'll probably have a lot to do with Chrome 18, which has just arrived. And they've added some new HTML5 elements, such as Canvas, which I don't know what that is.
The Canvas is like the graphics rendering engine, if you will. That's not really the right word for that, but that is what you use to display graphics. And they're going to add hardware acceleration. So Internet Explorer has actually already done this in 9, and that was one of their big things as well. Hardware accelerated web, and this is Chrome's response to that, more or less. And I just checked, and my Chrome is up to date, because Chrome is always up to date.
Yes, it is. Well, I look forward to watching YouTube videos without my computer exploding.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, Flash is hardware accelerated, so there's always that.
Right. Well, no, Flash is hardware accelerated on PCs.
Oh, is it not in Safari?
They've made some steps toward it, but it's not there yet. And I can tell just by watching my core temperatures.
Yikes. Well, that's not, it's not too great.
No, it's not. And it causes my computer to overheat. But let's not overheat. Let's turn off the afterburners.
No, let's turn off the afterburners, slow down a little bit. You know, you can't go to html5.youtube.com. Isn't all the video there?
Oh, yeah. All my YouTube videos are automatically switched to HTML.
Okay, good, good.
Through plugins and extensions and stuff. But it's other Flash elements that are really bad for my computer. But I'm hoping that Google Chrome 18 will help my computer even more.
Yeah, so is Google bad for your computer?
Well, Chrome is something I like to use, but there has been a lot of news this week coming out against Google. So, hey, Chris, did you read that article when that Goldman Sachs guy left and he published in the Wall Street Journal, like, why I left Goldman Sachs? And he said, the culture is ruined and everything's changed and I don't like it anymore. And they made me cry and they killed my dog.
Right. Yeah. It's like the, you know, you leave the door, you open the door to leave Goldman Sachs and you turn around and, like, throw a shaving cream hand grenade back there just to stick it to the man.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that was what James Whitaker in mind, had in mind, but he is a senior Google developer who left, and everybody wanted to know why he left. He didn't say anything bad about Google, but he did give a pretty comprehensive blog post about how the Google that exists now is not the same for its employees that it was when he started there.
Yeah,
he said it's very much focused on increasing ad revenue and focusing on collecting and aggregating personal data. And I guess it always was about that, and he admits it. But it's they've figured out, I guess, the specific vectors by which they want to go, and they're going specifically for that. And so it's less about creativity and more about implementation.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I mean, Google's maturing as a company, and as the company moves forward, whether forward means better or worse is kind of arbitrary. You know, the company's going to change a little bit, and it would be naive to assume otherwise. Now, not to say he's naive per se, but you know, things move along for the better or for the worse. The company matures, so I think maybe he's lamenting the fact that Google no longer has this kind of startup mentality.
Yeah, I suppose that's part of it. I mean, I wouldn't really even call what he's describing a startup mentality. But maybe definitely a free money mentality, this idea of experimentation.
Yeah, kind of the, you remember when Facebook published the, I forget what they called that thing, but it was like a hacker manifesto and how they developed Facebook and how they are consistent with the hacker way.
Right. So after I read this blog from James Whitaker, Google published something last week called The Case Against, or sorry, Gizmodo published an article called The Case Against.
Surprised if that were Google.
So Gizmodo wrote The Case Against Google, which basically goes a step or two further. And they say that people who are paying attention to what Google's doing don't trust Google with their data anymore. We, the internet, don't implicitly trust what Google is doing with our data. And they kind of elaborate on this a little bit. They say that Google has changed its definition of what evil was. I mean, Google's famous motto is don't be evil.
Yeah.
And so it seems like they've kind of hedged their bets a little bit on that.
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, do you really think they're being evil with anything they're doing right now?
I don't think they're being evil, but I think some people's definitions 10 years ago is of what Google's version of evil is. That might be what they're doing today. Maybe.
All right. That's a little more reasonable. Now, right. I don't know. I mean,
and then, but then a lot more other people, when faced with that juxtaposition, they could easily believe that Google's on a slippery slope now.
Right. Well, I mean, sort of. I mean, do you really distrust Google at this point in time?
Well, I take it with a grain of salt now. Well, yeah. When I was reading this article, I was legitimately thinking about migrating away from Google.
I mean, I look at this and I think, well, okay, so I'm going to move away from Google, right? Where am I going to get my email from?
Okay, but being locked in is not an excuse for them to do evil.
Yeah, well, that's true, I guess. But, I mean, at the end of the day, they make good products that suck you into.
An excuse for you to stay with them.
No, but it is, because they make good products that I'd like to use, is the point.
Deal with the devil. It's you, like if they're truly in a downward spiral, you're going to have to switch at some point, better sooner than later.
Yeah, I'm going to start hosting my own mail server on my home server. No, I'm not. That will not happen.
Yeah.
If it does happen, I'll write a post about it.
By the way, Google Search, Gmail, Google Plus, these are not products. They're free. We are the products.
Oh, yeah, I understand that, sort of. But at the end, like, I have Gmail, and it's awesome. So, yeah, that is a product, and I am using it, and it's also fantastic.
No, it's a service.
The service. Okay, I could see that distinction.
It's a service to ad companies.
Right. Yeah, no, I do not doubt that they, you know, I know how they make their money, but it doesn't really make me uncomfortable that advertisers know things about me.
No, and I agree. The flip side of this coin is that...
By the way, Google's trying to shut down your Skype here.
Yeah, there's nothing that's hurting. Can Google do that?
They can.
Uh-oh. Well, that's evil.
Now, that would be evil. So if Google was reaching into your Skype to screw up your connection, that would definitely be evil, and I would definitely be against that. But just kind of like aggregating information to serve more relevant ads to me doesn't really bother me at all.
Yeah, okay, I agree with that. I guess it's pushing buttons a little bit to say that Google has gone evil. I definitely don't believe that to be the case. I just think it's worth reading these two articles.
Oh, it's definitely worth reading the two articles. And it's definitely worth... I mean, so I'm in a different position than most people who use all of the Google services, because I know what they're taking. Most people look at Google services and they say, oh, okay, well, free email. And then they move on with their life and they don't realize what they're giving up in doing so. So I could see that.
I think it's also worth pointing out that you know exactly what they're taking from you, and you're also more reliant on Google than most people.
I am more reliant on most people. You know, like, I have my Google apps for my domain at barnesian.com, and you know, I mean, I like Google apps. What am I supposed to say? You know, we use Google Docs to make the show notes so Google knows exactly what we're going to be talking about every week. So they better not malign us. But it doesn't bother me that they're aggregating this information. Now, if I see them doing something with that information that's not trustworthy, that's when I start to get worried. It's not the fact that they're aggregating the information that makes me terribly worried. It's when they start to do something with it. Of course, maybe then it's too late.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what they're starting to do now. That's exactly what is happening right now.
And so, I mean, what, they're going to push Google Plus?
Yeah, they do. When you search for something on Google.com, Google Plus is the first thing that comes up.
Right, so I guess that's the point of this entire conversation is that, well, okay, so use Bing, right? That's the whole point is, well, okay, it's time to be leery now.
Okay, my point was never use Bing.
Okay, use DuckDuckGo or what is that? Bleco, the hash... search engine.
Sticking with Alta Vista, thank you very much.
Alta Vista.
I'm going to go ask Jeeves if it's all the same to you.
All right. Yeah, you can ask Jeeves. You should ask Jeeves about the end user. What do you think he'd say?
Probably nothing.
Yeah, he'd say, here's a page of results. No, ask.com is still around, right? Yeah, they're still here. I just had a look.
No, that makes sense. But they've got to be powered by somebody else, I think, right?
Yeah, it's more than likely.
Right.
It's definitely more than likely.
All right. Well, it's more than likely that Sprint has released a couple of new phones this past week, most notably the LG Viper 4G LTE and the Sprint HTC Evo 4G LTE. They really kind of stopped putting 4G LTE on the end of the name here.
Yeah, I mean, these marketing guys just can't help themselves, right? It's like, what was last week we talked about the Verizon Wi-Fi tethering device. These guys just can't help themselves. It's the marketing guys and the engineers that ruin everything for naming products.
Yeah, they should not be in charge of that.
No, definitely not.
The Evo 4G LTE, the early results are it's the best Android phone for Sprint. And the LG Viper 4G LTE will be available. And so these are both obviously running Sprint's new LTE network, which they've announced. And they're pretty much abandoning WiMAX going forward.
Well, they've also said that they can retool some of the WiMAX towers retool the equipment on the towers that give off WiMAX to switch to LTE, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's not surprising to me at all, just as long as somebody goes up there and changes the antenna. But if there is an easier way to do that, then they'll be lucky because that'll save them some money.
Yeah, and by the way, the Viper is only $100, so that's kind of neat. Going right up against the Lumia 900.
Yep, that is true. And the, I guess the iPhone is not LTE.
No, but it is 4G according to the new icon at the top of the...
iPhone 4 is not, only the 4S.
The 4S, right.
It's not real 4G. It's marketing 4G.
There is no real 4G. We've been over this on the end user. 4G is not a sanctioned the end user term. You have to say HSPA plus. It's like talking.
Yeah, but it still bothers you when they call HSPA plus 4G, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Well, I we can only do what we can do and say HSPA plus and have people look at us strangely because they know is 4G.
Right. Okay, but in case you're wondering whether Sprint's going to start capping their bandwidth on their new LTE network, the answer is they're not going to. Yet.
For now. Yeah, so this is pretty encouraging. Maybe I should switch to Sprint. I always get prickly when we talk about capping data plans and stuff like that because we know that it's not an effective way to manage network traffic.
And now they have a decent new Android phone.
Now they have a decent new Android phone with LTE. So, yeah.
Well, that's I guess, yeah. Exciting. But it's not ice cream sandwich, is it? So.
No, it's not ice cream sandwich.
Oh, no, the HTC... The Evo 4G is.
Yeah, the Evo 4G is. The Viper is not, if I got that right.
Well, so there's an option. Get yourself some unlimited data.
Yeah, what's their Windows phone selection like? Actually, they had the cool, at launch, they had that cool Windows phone, the one with the keyboard slide out, the HTC Pro 7. That was kind of neat.
Yeah, that's way outdated now, but I'm sure they'll get something.
Yes, maybe they're not going to get the Nokia devices because Nokia basically only does GSM.
No, that's not new. That's not true. Nokia has had a slew of CDMA phones in the past, but they've been out of that market for several years.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about Android some more. Instagram has hit the... See, now what am I supposed to say here? Here's the problem with the marketing term Google Play, or the branding, rather. Google Play. How am I supposed to say Instagram is available on Google Play? Is that how you say it?
Just say it plays.
It plays. Instagram plays. Next story.
And 1 million people played it.
Yeah, so Instagram has officially been released into the wild, into the Google Play market, into the Google Play, onto the Google Play, or however you say that.
You're gonna have to work this out off air, Chris.
Yeah, we're gonna have to figure this out one day. But yeah, this is interesting. We were pretty negative about Instagram the other week when we shared the news that it was going to be available for Android soon, and now it's available. So I can say I am still negative about it, having used it, because all it does is force close on my phone. But maybe there are some Android users out there who have a different opinion about the basic mechanism by which Instagram works in the first place, and B, that it doesn't force close on their phone.
Yes, hopefully that is not the experience of the majority Android Instagram users.
I'm sure it's not. My phone is super old, so I actually can't blame Instagram for that.
Well, if you want to.
If you have an opinion about Instagram on Android and why Instagram is so attractive to people, just give us an email, theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com.
I feel like that's something that would get a lot of reads. Just somebody explaining why Instagram is actually good.
Why are hipsters using the Instagram?
No, why are non-hipsters using Instagram?
Oh, yeah. Why are the masses using it?
Right.
Yeah, I just don't understand the attraction to this app. But, I mean, clearly it's massive, and clearly I'm the one who's weird. So if you want, send us some feedback at the email I just mentioned, or you can get us at the end user, of course. So.
Right. Well, now that it's not iOS only, I can't use it anymore.
Right. Yeah, because that's how Apple people are. I know.
Our next two stories are
no comeback.
iPad only. So, Chris, what do you think about Tapose? Is that what we're calling it?
Tapose. Well, you know, I don't have an iPad, so I can't really use this application. But it's kind of the brainchild of the people who worked at Microsoft to develop the skeleton that was the Courier previously. So it's got this kind of dual page idea with a little pocket in the middle where you can stick things and take notes and stuff like that. And I think the idea looks like it could be useful, but at the same time, it's just too complicated is the thing. I mean, you're looking at this person go through the interface, and it's just this mess of different paradigms about how you put things into different places. And so I'm not sure that that's going to be terribly successful, but I could see an app like this in power users' hands being really, really powerful. But I don't know. So we'll have to wait and see, because apparently it's a little buggy as well. So we'll have to wait for it to mature a little bit.
Well, if that's buggy and complicated, then the obvious solution is the second app, Paper.
And Paper's the exact opposite. It's really, really simple and well executed, and you can write notes with a pen. And the pen's like it's kind of like a felt marker kind of thing.
It's just a stylus.
Well, no, I mean, the resolution of the iPad screen with a pen is that of a felt tip marker.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Because of the nature of the screen, you know, it's not a Wacom tablet, right?
Right.
But I don't know. What do you think? Would you take handwritten notes?
Well, I haven't had a chance to try either of these yet, but I look forward to trying them out pretty soon.
Yeah,
I probably wouldn't take handwritten notes. And actually, honestly, I don't even draw that much either. So yeah, I'm probably not going to use either of these much.
I mean, I get the feeling it's kind of similar to other tablet apps that we've talked about before where, you know, okay, that's cute, but artists use a Wacom tablet and most people don't draw anyway. So, I don't know, and I'd rather type. I'd rather have a keyboard and type so that I don't have to look down at the screen to take my notes. Sorry, I'm mixing a couple things up there. Let me correct myself. I'd rather type on a hardware keyboard than a software keyboard, at least while taking notes, so that I don't have to look at the screen. And if I were using a stylus, I wouldn't have to look at the screen, but I also don't want to take notes by hand either.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I do most of my note taking these days on my iPhone whenever possible, which at first I felt weird about, but then I learned that Scott Forstall of Apple does it.
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense, right?
Yep.
I, at least for work purposes, I use my netbook for a lot of that stuff. But if I'm out somewhere and I want to write something down, there's no way I'm going to whip out my netbook and boot up Windows 8 and then, you know, type it into Evernote and then close it and then put it back. No, that doesn't make sense. So, yeah, so I do a little bit of both of those things, but I don't know. So this fits into the kind of weird category, but people are excited about it.
Seem to be.
You know, I mean, this is an app that, for all intents and purposes, is just kind of a new finger paint app that happens to have a stylus associated with it, and people are really freaking out. So I think this is the first of these kinds of apps, which aren't really mature yet, and we will see these things mature over time, and it's going to be interesting to see where these things go in the future.
Yeah, it will be interesting, and I guess we'll see. I look forward to playing with them in their current iterations,
I have to try them. Right, I'm kind of speaking off the cuff here because I don't really know. You know, I'd have to get an iPad and newspaper to actually know if it would be terribly useful.
Well, I'm sure there'll be an Android version soon, but neither of us have tablets of any form, so.
Yeah, we gotta fix
it. Hard for us to judge, but we can talk about it.
I'm holding out for the Windows 8 tablet, I think.
Oh ho!
So, speaking of the future, we've got a new stereo Bluetooth headset, and I love stereo Bluetooth headsets, and companies don't make enough of them. Is the problem?
So this one's from Plantronics, and you already have a Plantronics Bluetooth stereo headset, don't you?
Yeah, I have the previous version of this, and it's awesome. Stereo Bluetooth headsets are fantastic.
And, when I first saw this and I put it into the story, I said, but this is just so crazy small. And then, Chris, you pointed out that it's not even the smallest that's been made. But
this product exists already.
But they stopped making that one.
Yeah, they did stop making that one. That was a Sony Ericsson headset. And right. I don't know why more people don't use stereo Bluetooth. I mean, what do you want wires for? It's the worst thing ever.
A lot cheaper.
When you go out of your house in the morning, do you like put your earphones on and like thread the cord through your shirt and then have it come out the bottom and put your phone in your pocket?
I do that, actually. Yeah, I do.
See, that's ridiculous. You should have a wireless set of earphones, for God's sake.
You're right. I should upgrade. These seem like pretty cool. I may pull the trigger on this one.
Yeah, now they're $100, so they are a bit pricey, and I think...
No Bluetooth 4.0 support.
Deal breaker. Well, no, I mean, Bluetooth 4.0 is more about data transfer, isn't it, than...
No, it's also a low power profile.
Low power, right. That's right. But yeah, these are pretty exciting. It doesn't matter that they don't have 4.0. It's fine.
And you're right. It doesn't actually matter.
The one comical thing about having a stereo Bluetooth headset is that you have to charge your headphones every night. It's a little weird.
So that's the real trade-off of the wires, right?
Yeah, that is the real.
Make sure your headphones are charged.
That is the real trade-off. Oh, the headset is called the Backbeat Go from Plantronics. That's the one we're talking about. And if you want to read a little bit more about it, if you're also enthusiastic about wireless earphones, because everything should be wireless in the future, then go to our show notes and hit up the link and read the CNET article. And the one we were talking about previously was the Sony Ericsson HBH-IS-800Z. A compelling name.
Yeah, well, headphones don't always have to have compelling names, although I guess the ones with compelling names sell pretty well.
Yeah, like Beats. Beats is a marketing fury that cannot be stopped.
Or Bose Quiet Comfort.
Yeah, or Bose too. They're terribly overpriced and sound great. So, in fact, I'm wearing Bose right now.
I'm wearing Logitech.
All right, well, let's move on to our last story before our tip of the week. We've got some hacking advice for you, I guess.
Oh, boy. Really rubbing it in this week. And another way to break into Macs.
Yeah, I'm really... So you need to share more security articles about Windows. I'm kind of gliding under the radar here.
I guess I do. So this one is actually pretty scary in how easy it is. So Macs with OS X Lion have a built-in recovery partition that's hidden in your hard drive, and so you can boot your computer into a recovery mode.
Right.
Once you're in recovery mode, you can just go into the terminal and then type reset password.
Wait, do you get full terminal access in recovery mode?
Apparently.
That is scary.
But do you know what recovery mode also has? It has Track My Mac. So if someone steals your computer and boots into recovery mode, you can then track the computer from online.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of cool. Assuming that it pings a Wi-Fi network or something like that.
Right, and that Wi-Fi has some sort of GPS location.
Yeah, so if you forgot your password, this is a good way to recover your password. Or a better piece of advice would be to put a password on your EFI. I always want to call them EFI BIOS, but they're just EFI. But right. Yeah, put a password on your EFI so that this cannot happen. Because if they try to change your password and your EFI is password protected, then they can't get into the recovery partition in the first place because they can't boot it at all. So that would be how to fix this. And this is a little scary because I know, you know, most normal humans who have a Mac are not going to put a password on their EFI. So it's a little scary.
No, yeah, that's true. And I don't have a password on my EFI, but after reading this, I'm considering it.
Definitely so. And I password protect my BIOS on mobile computers as well. I would suggest, even if you're using Windows, you might as well put the password on the BIOS level so that people can't get in and wipe the hard drive and stuff like that. It's just plain a good idea for computers that are not going to be leaving your desk.
Yep, good call. So, scary problem, easy fix.
And if you want to help fix these kind of problems, we have a good tip of the week for you.
Ah, yeah, that's true. Well, you won't get to these problems directly. So this comes from Code Academy, which I've been using to help myself learn JavaScript, that's previously all they had was free JavaScript coding classes. And that's what they're using for their code year this year. They're trying to get as many people as possible to learn basic JavaScript in 2012. But now they've added HTML and CSS, which is a great way to get started with web development and programming in general.
Yeah. Those are the predominant languages, so it makes sense. It's a good place to start. The W3C also has a bunch of good resources for this, but this is cool.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, if you wanted to just learn a little bit of basic programming, especially for just like a website that you maintain for yourself or maybe some company, this is an awesome way to get started. Code Academy is a great website, and I like using it a lot. And HTML and CSS.
But why would you want to get into basic programming? That doesn't make sense. Go back and use DOS if you want to get
Well, that's how we started, Chris. Don't you remember?
Yeah, that is how we got started.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that's a really common starting language, is using the big blue screen with QBasic.
Well, it was in 1990. It probably isn't so much anymore.
Yeah, usually when I go to develop something these days, I'm not confronted with a big blue command line screen.
Just zeros and ones, right?
Yeah, I program in binary.
After a while, you don't even see the code for anymore. Speed. It's just blonde, brunette, redhead.
It's like the Gmail April Fool's joke, where if you haven't heard of it, they have this video explaining why their Gmail app will only have two buttons. and it's the dot and the dash, you know, from Morse code.
Yeah, I really don't understand why they had to use two buttons for that. Even as a joke. It's one button. Morse code is one button.
Yeah, double click and single click, right? So the all you really need to program, and forget this website that we just passed along, you just need a two button keyboard. There you go. Game over. Or not. Definitely not, actually. Not suggestible.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, that's our tip of the week. That's all I got. What's our kicker this week, Chris?
All right, we've got a really cool story. I love this. Talk about
it is the opposite of cool, this story.
No, it's fantastic. The it's an open source tricorder. What's not to love?
So a cognitive science researcher named Dr. Peter Jansen built his own hardware for a Linux-powered tricorder replica from Star Trek, and it's actually functional. He put all the sensors he could possibly fit into it, and basically just turned it into a tricorder, and he put the codes online, and it runs
even the hardware.
An ARM microcontroller, he's just trying to use Star Trek technology as a way to get people into science, I guess.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, this, you know, as a kid, you see this kind of thing, and maybe you've seen Star Trek and you've liked Star Trek or something, and you see this kind of thing, and it could kind of kick you off into wanting to be able to maybe use Arduino or something, you know, who knows? Yeah, for science.
Science!
So it's cool. So there's this guy published a blog post, and all of his code is under GPL license. So you can go out there and check out all of his designs and all of his code, and that's really neat. Now, we just need to get more useful sensors on here. I mean, he's got temperature, humidity, pressure, magnetic fields, color, ambient light, GPS, and distance, so a range finder. We need more than that. So it's up to the rest of you to figure out more sensors to put in this thing and how to use them.
Right. Yeah. Why not modify the design?
Yeah, because I'm not doing it.
Definitely need to add a sensor for subspace. That comes in really critical in a lot of the episodes of Star Trek. Maybe tachyons. You want to build a tachyon sensor for sure.
Yes, and perhaps neutrinos, if I could make a suggestion. It'd be a good start.
Well, our current neutrino sensors are quite large. I don't think you could fit that in a handheld device.
Well, no, but that's the future. That's what it should be. You should have a neutrino sensor in a tricorder.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, no problem.
Moore's Law says it'll happen. Damn it, it will.
Not really. I don't think Moore's Law can account for that.
No, not currently. All right, well, that will do it for this week. Taylor, what are you on Twitter?
On Twitter, I am at TaylorPhone.
And I'm at Chris Hale Barnes. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information and the show notes at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's thendusr.com. The DMZ has a few other podcasts, so have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Seen in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can also send us some feedback, as we mentioned earlier. We are theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We are @theenduser.
Or like us on Facebook.
You can join the show as we record it live every Wednesday night, usually around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Moore.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Science!